906. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As a new generation of college graduates grapples with uncertain job prospects, a mountain of student debt, and diminished personal expectations, some critics argue that the traditional model of a liberal arts education has outlived its usefulness in preparing students for a productive future. The rapid pace of technological change and employer demands for an increasingly specialized workforce have led some to question the value of an expensive liberal arts education as the pathway to an economically viable career. But in a new book, Wesleyan University President Michael Roth challenges these critics by arguing that turning away from liberal education would be a short-sighted and self-defeating path to economic stagnation and conformity. He claims that students need a liberal education in order to develop the critical thinking skills and intellectual inquisitiveness necessary for a lifetime of innovation and positive contribution to society. Today on The Exchange, the future of liberal arts education. Let's hear from you. What's been your own experience with liberal arts education? Do you think there's too much emphasis placed on the need for a college degree? How can we best prepare our children for a productive future? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me by phone from Middletown, Connecticut this morning is Michael Roth. Mr. Roth is the 16th president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. He was previously president of California College of the Arts and has written extensively on topics in history and the humanities. Michael Roth, thanks for joining us for The Exchange this morning.
Great to be here, Dean.
Before we talk about the book, perhaps you could give our listeners a brief sketch of your own professional career. There are many different pathways to a college presidency, and you've now held two of them. So maybe you could give us the highlights of that journey.
Oh, sure. My road was a rather crooked one, I guess. I'm in the first generation of my family to go to college. My father was a furrier, like his father. They made fur coats, and my mother was a singer who gave up singing to raise her kids. And I was a student at Wesleyan University in the mid-70s and got my PhD in history at Princeton just shortly thereafter. In my case, I became a faculty member in California at the Claremont Colleges, and I was at Scripps College, Women's College, for 12 years. And I was the kind of professor that the presidents hated. I was always suspicious of any administrative activities and thought they were all, you know, it was kind of a bloated sector of the school. And at some point, after several years there, I was invited to the Getty Center to work on a book I was writing, and then eventually an exhibition, a couple of exhibitions I curated. And I was there for about 5 years. And towards the end of that time, someone called me and asked me if I'd be interested in the presidency of the California College of Arts and Crafts, CCAC. And I said to this person from the search firm, "Oh, I guess you got the wrong guy. There are a lot of Michael Roths in academia." I didn't know the first thing about running a school. At the Getty, my job was to give away money, and you know, we all thought it was very difficult work, but you know, it wasn't in retrospect. She said, no, you were my history teacher at Scripps. I know who you are, and you're the out-of-the-box candidate. So in any case, we had a little, our daughter, now 17, was very little. My wife wanted to leave L.A. She's also a professor. And to my great surprise, the good folks at CCAC, now it's called CCA, California College of the Arts, hired me. They said, years later, I asked them, how the heck could you hire a guy like me? I didn't even know how to read a spreadsheet. And they said that I inspired them, or words to that effect. And there were other people around me who knew how to do the what I think of as the real work. And I'm not an artist, far from it, but I love being around artists and designers and architects, and had a great time at CCA, 12 years in Oakland and San Francisco and Berkeley. And the only thing that would have drawn us back to the East Coast was what happened was that Wesleyan at some point called and said, would you be interested in talking to us about the presidency? And Wesleyan had so changed my life as a young person. You know, I had never thought of being a professor. I never met a professor who wasn't giving me grades until I got to Wesleyan. So when they asked me, I thought, no way they're going to offer me this job. You know, it's just they didn't seem to know where, you know, the art school was. They didn't seem to care about the work in California, I thought. And long story somewhat shorter, at the end of this process, they called to offer me the job, or called my wife actually to tell her because I was on a plane back to San Francisco. And I just burst into tears. I was so moved and I guess elated at the prospect of coming back to the school I really loved as a, you know, as a youngster, to try to guide it into these turbulent times. So I still teach every semester. I still write books when I can. My friends kid me that I try not to tell anyone I'm a president. I always say I'm a teacher. But it's been really an interesting time to be at the helm of a university.
So you really came full circle. It's interesting. You're twice an out-of-the-box candidate, but now you're in the position of writing this very passionate defense of liberal arts education, which leads me to the question, why write this book now? I should note for our listeners that the book was published earlier this year by Yale University Press. You've been at Wesleyan since 2007 as president, so you've been thinking about these issues, but why put this down on paper now?
That's a great question. All of my work up until now, my scholarly work, has been about how people make sense of the past. So I published a book just a couple of years ago called Memory, Trauma, and History, Essays on Living with the Past, and that kind of what I've done since the beginning of my career is to think about how people make sense of the past. And over the last few years, I started to think about these debates today around higher education and the rhetoric around disruption, which is, you know, seemed kind of got my the meter through which we detect nonsense, I guess, is the long way of saying what your listeners will understand.
Just a quick question, clarification: when you talk about disruption, are you talking about institutions disrupting traditional notions of liberal arts?
Yeah, you know, like well, not just liberal arts, but the business model for higher education, mm-hmm. and that we should. We can no longer afford a broad education, and that we can no longer afford students actually discovering what they want to do with their lives. We have to actually tell them what they should do with their lives, and that we need shortcuts for everything. And, you know, the Clay Christensen introduced the disruption model, which has now, I think, been thoroughly dismantled by Jill Lepore. In talking about the automobile industry and the record industry and the newspapers, and they started to apply the education. The whole education system should fall apart, they argued. And I found this, you know, disturbing, but also it seemed to me a little bit like a little snake oil salesman-ish. and so I, as a historian, I started to wonder, is this a new thing? And I'm not an American historian, but I started poking around in American history to look back at other times when there was economic pressure and what were some of the debates around universities. And I started to, you know, just do more, a little bit more research about it. And at some point said, you know, instead of writing little pieces for the Wesleyan magazine or give speeches here and there at different education institutions where I'm really preaching to the choir, I should try to write something more for the general reader. And because I do believe that although higher education must change, as it has changed over centuries, you know, people talk about the lectures haven't changed since the Middle Ages. That's nonsense. Schools have changed dramatically in every generation. But we need to find ways to deliver a more powerful education to more people at a reasonable cost,
and we'll get into the details of cost and other possible paradigms. But before we talk in greater detail about the core of your mm-hmm. critique in the book, could you give for our listeners just a brief definition before the break of what we typically mean by a liberal arts education. I know that that may be a difficult concept to parse down, but just to kind of let people know sort of what we're talking about here.
Sure. And you use the phrase like most people would of liberal arts education. I just use liberal education. Liberal arts education in Europe was really built around a core set of disciplines that everybody was supposed to know that would provide you with breadth and provide you with sophistication and kind of indicate that you were a person who didn't have to work all the time. You're a person of leisure. In America, liberal education is built around the notion that a broad contextual education that examines the connections between what you're trying to learn and other things in the university and in your life is the best way of instructing people who are going to become citizens, stand on their own two feet, and resist oppression. So liberal education in America isn't built around Greek and Latin or in history and religion or any particular set of disciplines. And what I argue for in the book is a pragmatic liberal education, which means that whatever you're studying, study it in context, study it so you understand the concepts that make that field possible, and see its connections to other things. Don't just study one thing in isolation from all other things, because
so it's actually a very active notion of education. I think, as you
know,
people often think of liberal arts as kind of sort of static, the great books, kind of very sort of antiquities almost.
Yeah, and that hasn't been true even at liberal arts colleges for decades. And 25 years ago, liberal arts institutions were being criticized for abandoning great books. You know that we and now they're being criticized for being focused on great books. Neither one is really true. What we want to focus on, whatever we're teaching, whether it's books or films or movies or skills, is how the thing you're interested in learning is related to other things that are relevant to what you're going to do after you graduate. And that's the core of my book. That's why it's called Beyond the University, because it's really not about what you're learning right now. It's about learning things now that you can use after you leave the campus.
Let me jump in a second, President Roth. We need to take a brief break. We're going to come back and talk a lot more about liberal arts education with Michael Roth. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your best source for news for elections 2024. Click over right now to read interviews with candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate and governor, airing all week on All Things Considered. Political news and information are online every day at NHPR.org. New Hampshire weather, sunshine today, hot, highs mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Mostly clear tonight, some clouds moving in after midnight in the North Country. Lows tonight, mid-50s north, ranging mid-60s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Altos Investment Group in Concord, offering securities through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. Supporting primary reporting, September 9th, altusinvest.com. And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with Wesleyan University President Michael Roth about the value of a liberal arts education. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Michael, before the break, we were talking about the definition of liberal arts. I think you pointed out that it should be a more kind of active notion of engaging the world rather than this kind of static model that we may think of traditionally. Let's talk about the core of the critique against liberal education. I mean, to me, you talk in the book a lot about this criticism that people have that college should really be focusing more on marketable skills, positioning people for the job market, particularly given kind of the rapid pace of technological change. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that critique and then how you address it.
Sure. Well, I think there are two parts to the critique. One is as old as the United States, which is that the critique that higher education sometimes just produces snobs who act sophisticated in sophisticated ways because they've learned things that allow them to pretend they're they're more intelligent than everybody else.
This is the elitism.
Yeah, the elitism critique. Yes. You know, and Ben Franklin did that, and all through American history, you have people who say, come on, you guys at some fancy school, you fill in the blank which fancy school it is, all you're doing up there is kind of learning how to be pretentious. And that's a good critique. It's a great American critique. You know, Ben Franklin made it, but then he also started the University of Pennsylvania, and he also started book clubs. And so he was asking, saying, give me a real education. Don't give me that just elitist nonsense. The other kind of critique, which is, I think, much more powerful these days, is that, you know, we can't really afford to give people a broad, holistic education. We have to give them an education that they can use tomorrow or this evening, you know, something that will be very direct. Now, what I find so troubling about this is that the people making that argument are often the products of a very broad liberal education. So whether it's the guys running foundations in Silicon Valley or high-tech companies or other institutions, that these guys had the education, and then they say, well, but we can't afford to give it to people who are going to have entry-level jobs. We can't afford to give it to everybody. We don't want the bartender to know anything about chemistry. That's silly. We don't want the cab driver to know anything about literature. That's silly. Now, this is anti-democratic.
What's the motivation for that, do you think?
They want a docile workforce that they can that can go into entry-level jobs and stay there and conform to the status quo. And instead, what we need are people who can learn the skills to meet the needs of the market today, but also be able to put those skills in a perspective that allows them to keep learning. Because of the rapid pace of change, we need people who are working at all levels who can adapt to change, actually shape change, and not just be victimized by change. So I am very suspicious of the people who make the argument that liberal education is irrelevant, except for their own kids or except for themselves. And so I do think the argument for this practical education, first of all, it's not very practical if things are changing so rapidly. And second of all, it is elitist, and it cuts it against the American grain that, you know, from Thomas Jefferson on, that says education should prepare us to be citizens so that we will not be fooled by either rich elites or by the government.
Well, I think in terms of the job force or the labor force argument, I think you say in your book that the pitfall here is that if you focus on vocational training, specialized training, you're essentially prepping for last year's jobs or sort of the job market as it was at just a brief moment in time.
Exactly. And, you know, I tell the students here at Wesleyan and their parents, I'll do this tomorrow when they all arrive, is that you don't want to invest all this time and money into preparing for the worst job you'll ever have, which is the first one. But on the other hand, the anxiety that people feel today, and I think it's, you know, justified and real, is that if I don't get that first job, what's going to happen to me? Because, you know, when I was in school and I was deciding to become a historian, not the most practical thing, I remember telling my dad, you know, there are no jobs out there. What am I going to do? And he looked at me and said, well, you know how to earn money. You had a job in a kitchen. My uncle was a cab driver. You know how to earn a few bucks. But if you don't try something you really think you might love, you're always going to wonder. Now, today, that's harder to do because of the radical economic inequality in the United States. People worry, if I don't get on that ladder, I might be on public assistance.
Well, and I was going to ask you, what do you say to the student who has graduated from an elite liberal arts college and is now living at home and, you know, not getting quite the job that they want, maybe thinking about going to graduate school because nothing else is going on? What do you tell that? I mean, what should be their strategy going forward, given their education as you see it?
Well, I think their strategy going forward is to always develop skills along with developing this broad perspective that allows you to continue to learn after you graduate. I don't think we should be elitist about it and say, oh, when you graduate from Wesleyan or from Dartmouth or from Southern Hampshire or from Harvard, wherever it is, that it's not our business whether you get a job. We just taught you how to think. That seems to me really inappropriate. I want my students to be competitive for jobs, but I also want them to be able to think about how that job fits into their lives more generally, and also to think about the next job and a meaningful career. So I do think that That's why I call liberal education of the kind that I'm describing pragmatic liberal education. We can't afford, nor should we cultivate, a group of people who can just sit in their homes and think about great books or poetry or music. We need people who are capable of learning from the world, reacting to what they've learned, and shaping new things. And so having the skills to do that is absolutely important. And, you know, when people graduate from a university, they shouldn't really be showing folks a list of classes that they've taken. They should be able to show people what they've done with what the education they've had, which show what they will be able to do in the future. It's not about just where you've graduated. It's about what you're capable of accomplishing.
And I want to let our listeners know, we are talking about liberal arts education today, liberal education with Wesleyan University President Michael Roth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. And President Roth, let's talk a little bit about the cost of education. I think so much of the critique that you discuss in your book has been driven by uncertain economic times, the cost of education. You know, going to liberal arts college can run you anywhere from, you know, $30,000 a year upwards of $50,000 or $60,000 a year, depending on the school. Why is college so expensive?
Well, it's a great question. And one of the reasons it's expensive is because it's very labor intensive. And so the classes that are most effective are taught by highly qualified people in small classes. And so that takes a significant investment. On the other hand, it's also gotten very expensive in the United States because many colleges and universities are in this arms race of amenities, providing luxuries to students. And the reason they do that is not, I think, as some critics have said, just to feather their own nests. The reason they do that is because there's a strong appetite for it among parents and students. And I think it's a terrible thing for our education system that students are choosing schools because of their ability to spend tons of money on individual students, not through on their education, but on the luxuries they'll have on campus. And, you know, systems like the U.S. News and World Report system, they really just reward schools for spending more per student. And so we have gotten into a cycle where schools of all kinds are spending tons of money on students in ways that are not really connected to their core educational mission. And, you know, we've been changing that at Wesleyan, and and it's still too expensive, but we've been keeping our tuition increases just to inflation and raising money for financial aid. But this is we need to change that dynamic. But I don't think that's really connected to liberal education so much. It costs even more to get a technical education in the professions. And, you know, lots of the student debt that's piled up, the great disproportionate amount of the student debt that's piled up is piling up at for-profit, vocationally oriented schools. So I don't think cost and liberal education need to go together. And like Southern New Hampshire, Wesleyan has been experimenting, but not as aggressively as Southern New Hampshire, but Wesleyan has been experimenting with online courses, trying to find ways to reach students effectively in some classes at a much more at a much smaller cost. So I myself have taught these massive open online classes over the last couple of years.
Right, and you talk about your own experience in your book of teaching your first massive open online course.
Yeah, I'm you know, of the generation where I don't expect to enjoy the learning on a computer. I'm still, you know,
I'm not far behind you. I'm only a few years behind you. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I like going to lectures, but the idea of watching it on a computer puts me right to sleep. Nonetheless, I thought we ought to be investigating different kinds of pedagogy, and so I signed Wesleyan up, and then I put myself forward first to teach a very traditional humanities course, a kind of great books course, online. And I thought this would be the least likely course to work online. And I had, you know, tens of thousands of students sign up, and I communicated with many of them on discussion boards, and many of them, some of them with great, you know, advanced degrees already, some of them middle school students, most of them outside the U.S., many of the students expressed that this kind of course was transformational for them, opened up horizons for them. There were teachers in the class who expressed great gratitude that it gave them new ideas about how to teach their own classes. So I know that these classes can be effective. And it's only the first, it's only a few years in. I think they will become better over time. And for many places, a lot of the introductory courses we now give on campus, I think will probably be given in different ways in the future.
Michael, we have a comment on our Facebook page from Crystal, and this kind of feeds into what we've been talking about. And Crystal talks about the idea that, liberal, it's not so much liberal arts education, but it's kind of the provision of skills. So writing, communication, as opposed to, say, majoring in business or some other kind of applied, that it really kind of varies depending on what the skill set is for the job. So that liberal education kind of gives you these general skills, but it really depends on what the labor market is looking for at any given moment.
It does, and I think that the most successful candidates for jobs who have a broad education are those that can show how that broad education is connected to the problems or opportunities of the organization at hand. And so I sent a copy of this book to the head of human resources at Google because I had read a newspaper column about what he was looking for or what Google was looking for when they're hiring people. It's, of course, a lot of technical skills. But he wrote back and said that he himself, a graduate of Pomona College, a great liberal arts college out west, that they're looking for people who can think for themselves and create new opportunities in the organization, and that's not a technical skill. You also have to have some technical skills. but the technical skills are not enough. And I think giving students both the opportunity to learn technical skills and putting those skills in context is the sweet spot, both for getting a job and for getting the next job and thinking about what kind of work you want to do.
Yeah, interesting. We're talking both about kind of the general skills you get from a liberal arts education, but also the need for specific skills. And Maura posted on our Facebook page saying she'd like to see a hybrid. She is someone who had taken some college courses recently at a place that was heavily vocational, but she was also taking liberal arts. So she's asking about might there be sort of a happy medium here, or should you really have liberal arts colleges doing liberal education and other types of schools doing more technical vocational stuff?
Well, I do think it's important to say that liberal arts colleges today, and I know for sure at Wesleyan, are already hybrid schools. In other words, some of the largest majors at places like Wesleyan will be economics, computer science, and math. But also music and English and history. So I think the hybrid is already part of liberal education in America. America has, and that's why I call my kind of liberal education pragmatic liberal education. We are not a European system. The European system might say, okay, just you're a classics major, focus on classics. That's not been the American experience for the last 100 years. We've evolved a system where we expect people who are getting a broad education to also be able to make it useful in the world. That in order to do the work well, you have to be able to put your broad education into work in a specific area. So I think your listener is exactly right. We need hybrid models. And I think those hybrid models are the models of liberal education in the United States today.
So here's a curriculum-specific question for you. You talk in your book a lot about the theme of the need for students. You talk about learning to learn, which I thought was a very interesting phrase. And I guess my question is, within the context of liberal education, should students who come in kind of be forced to dabble? I know when I was in college in the early 80s, I had a set of extensive distributional requirements that I had to fulfill. The alternative model that I've read is you basically just let students chart their own course. And I think there are pluses and minuses to both approaches. What's your take on how do you get students into learning to learn?
Well, I'm a Wesleyan guy, so we hate requirements. And, even the faculty here today, they have expectations that 80% of our students or more take courses across the curriculum, you know, some in science, some in social science, et cetera. But we have officially an open curriculum, and there are schools like that, where we don't tell you you have to dabble. We try to present students with enough exciting options that they want to dabble. Now, my own personal view is that it's much better to have a student say, I really am interested in taking that class, and that's why I'm taking it, rather than, well, I have to take something in physics to check this box off on my transcript. Now, I realize that for some people, they'll never venture out of their comfort zone if you don't require them to do so. So I don't think that my view is for everybody. But I think it's preferable to entice people because of the quality of what you're teaching to try new things than it is to require them to try new things at the college level. In high school and, you know, before, I think, you know, requirements have a really important function. But what we try to do is to persuade and entice students to try new things because, you know, I'm in my case, I remember I thought I was going to be a writer. I wanted to be a novelist, you know, and I got shut out of a class when I was first starting. So I wandered into a philosophy class not knowing what the heck it was. You know, I didn't have philosophy in my big public high school. And I was just, you know, I was blown away by the teacher, by the stuff they were talking about. And it was a life-changing thing. Now, if I had to go and take, I don't know, required humanities course and just to check off a box, I think it would have been less powerful. So I guess some schools will have requirements, and that's fine. And I think offering some students who are adventurous intellectually the opportunity to take really exciting work in the sciences, in the social sciences and humanities, that works too.
Interesting. Along these same lines, Bill posted to our Facebook page, he says, it's really good to be exposed to all sorts of knowledge you never knew existed before you were exposed to it. So it sounds like you favor kind of creating a culture that encourages that rather than saying, okay, we're going to force you to get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, because I think when you force people, you actually have – you know, the economists call unintended consequences spring up. So you generate courses like, we used to call them rocks for jocks, a geology course in Claremont, that nobody really took that seriously and that people would just sign up to fulfill a requirement. And the professor didn't take everybody kind of eventually you were teaching to the test kind of you were teaching to the requirement rather than trying to create the most exciting possible course you could. And I realize that second option is sometimes utopian, but I do think it's very powerful. And I guess what I would say to the listeners is that a broad approach to any specific skill set will come in handy in the long run.
Let me jump in a second, President Roth. We need to take just one more break, but coming up, much more on liberal education with Wesleyan President Michael Roth. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, assessing police practices and the use of deadly force. Then the role of fraternities and sororities in today's college experience. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. A sunny, hot day across New Hampshire for today with high temperatures mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New London Bar and Playhouse, a professional theater closing their 82nd summer season with the classic thriller Dial M for Murder. Now through August 31st, information and tickets at nlbarn.org. And from Sovereignet Communications, serving the Northeast for nearly 20 years, connecting communities, schools, and businesses with over 4,500 fiber miles. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at New Hampshire's upcoming political primaries. You can join us with your thoughts by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook to continue the conversation there. And my guest today is Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University. He's a historian and author, and his most recent book is Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. And Michael Roth, let me draw you into a conversation about about a couple of kind of bigger issues, maybe a little bit off of the collegiate level, but important nonetheless. There's been a big debate in recent years here in New Hampshire and elsewhere about STEM programs. This is the science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think it's sort of a backdoor into this debate over vocational skills, specialized knowledge, et cetera. What's your take on the whole STEM debate?
Well, I think that it's absolutely important that our students have strong skills in the sciences. There's no question to me about that. I think the most powerful work in that area is done by people who can put this STEM work in context. In other words, STEM shouldn't be isolated from the rest of the university curriculum. And, you know, at liberal arts colleges, we send proportionally more students on to get PhDs in the sciences and mathematics than at the big state schools or research universities, by far. And why is that? Because you have people majoring in physics or in biochemistry or molecular biology who are also putting that in context. And you want scientists and technologists who are able to see not just the narrow specialization that they're particularly good at, but to see how that might fit into a wider picture. So I think the days are long gone when people who would have a liberal education that wouldn't include the sciences. We really want the emphasis on sciences, and I would actually like to have more engineering in liberal education institutions. But we want to be able to put that work in context. There's not a war between science and the humanities. They can actually complement each other very nicely.
So it sounds exactly. So it sounds like there's actually an opportunity to kind of integrate the critical learning from liberal arts with sort of the analytic aspect of these STEM programs.
Absolutely.
A related question. We've had a big debate in this state, and it's raging around the country on this issue of the Common Core at the secondary school level. But more generally, it feeds into the issue of and you mentioned, I think, testing earlier, how to measure outcomes. And I've heard this, you know, at the collegiate level as well. And, you know, should the federal government get involved in kind of making sure that everybody comes out with a certain set of skills? How do you go about assuring kind of a sort of quality control in terms of outcomes at the collegiate level?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, I think that the last thing we want to do is to have the federal government try to create the least efficient mechanism for evaluating outcomes that they don't understand, which is basically how the federal government does most of its evaluations. Because then you'll get them doing crude measures of how much you're making on your first job or something like that, and they'll get it wrong, and there'll be terrible consequences for lots of good schools. On the other hand, it's no longer good enough for a school to say, well, the students we accept at Stanford are really smart when they get in, and they're not that much stupider when they leave. You know, I mean, you need to actually have some way of showing what the students have learned while they're at the school beyond a list of classes. And I think every school should develop its own mechanisms for showing what students learn and then build on getting better at those things. So I'll give you an example. When I was president of the art school in San Francisco, we were, you know, being accredited, and we had to show that our students were getting better over time. And the faculty went crazy saying, how could you do that? This is art. How can you have a test? And we said, no, we're not having tests. We're making judgments. We make judgments at the school all the time. We say, this painting is terrible. This one is good. This sculpture is great. This is not good. That architectural plan doesn't work. This one does. We need to build an overlay on the individual judgments we make about work to show how a student progresses over time and how a class progresses over time. And I am hopeful that schools like Wesleyan and Dartmouth and other schools will develop mechanisms to show students themselves and their families that over time students are getting to be better writers, clearer thinkers, have more capacity to engage with the world because of the work they've done at the college or university.
But it sounds like some sort of national rubric of achievement would be difficult and problematic for you.
I think so. At the college level, I think you'll wind up dumbing it down. Look, I think one of the great things about America today is that thousands and thousands of students, of the best students from all over the world, want to come to the United States to go to college or university. There aren't too many other industries in America that have that kind of allure anymore. I mean, we have the best universities in the world. Not every university in America is at that level, but we have the best universities in the world. I was meeting with some parents yesterday who were dropping off their daughter there from Mumbai. They could have chosen hundreds of schools around the world, and they chose to bring their daughter to Wesleyan. And they say that lots of their friends, they desire so strongly to have their kids go to Yale or to Princeton or to Southern New Hampshire or to Dartmouth. And I think that we don't want to create a system, a federal system, that ignores the great achievements that are currently already happening at colleges and universities. Can we do better? Sure. But let's not forget, these are schools that have generated industry innovation, scientific innovation, and some of the great cultural achievements of the last half century.
Let's go to the phones now. And joining us from Dover is Betty. Betty, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Hi, Michael. I really like your idea about a practical liberal education and look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
My question has to do with how do you sort of help people have a broad education? One of the things that I really find lacking in a number of young people is good writing skills as
yeah.
well as good math skills beyond arithmetic into at least algebra. And even to me, a liberal education ought to include the concepts of calculus, if not, you know, the drudge of having to do it. And also in light of your concept of teaching people to think, some of the principles of business in terms of entrepreneurship in whatever field. And so I'm just interested in sort of what your thoughts are on those areas.
Thanks, Betty. That's actually a great question. Michael, I like this concept of entrepreneurship. How does that fit in?
Oh, it's a great question, Betty. And at Wesleyan, we've started a Center for Social Entrepreneurship in the last few years, really catching up with our students, many of whom go off and found companies or organizations either right after they graduate or sometimes while they're here. And so what we've been trying to do is to show how the skills of creating an organization or a company, which include math skills, writing skills, skills in psychology and sociology, and depending on the company, all other sorts of things, that creating such an organization or a company involves the integration of many different skills and is a great way of kind of testing your liberal education out in the world. So I think entrepreneurship is a wonderful vehicle for bringing together lots of the strands in liberal education. But Betty's question also reminds me that we have to remember that a lot of the liberal education issues are issues that should be addressed at the high school level, that students should be learning how to write more clearly at high school. They should be learning how to read critically, but also with sympathy and interest. And they should be learning critical thinking skills in high school. And, you know, until we fix the K-12 system, we're never going to be satisfied with what colleges provide, because many colleges in America are actually doing the work of high schools.
And just to let our listeners know, you can still call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. We're talking with Wesleyan President Michael Roth about liberal education. So join us with your thoughts. We have a little bit of time left here and a couple more questions for you, Michael. One issue that is kind of near and dear to my heart is this issue of civic engagement and service learning. And you talk a little bit in the book about that as a way to kind of get students out of the ivory tower. Could you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. One of the things that's happened over the last probably 20 years in many colleges and universities across the country is that we've recognized that the students develop the skills of a variety of sorts by working in community, and that the town-gown relation shouldn't just be about making sure the students don't go crazy on the weekend. They should be about partnering to deal with issues in your neighborhood with the brain power and horsepower of the university and the brain power and horsepower of the town or city you're in. So we have at Wesleyan and many schools have service learning courses, and we have a Center for Community Partnerships that works with the K-12 system, that works on issues of urban planning planning and environmental sustainability with our partners in the region here in Central Connecticut. And that's so key, because it's not that the university sets the agenda, it's the community groups that set the agenda, and they come to work with our students and faculty to jointly solve problems using a broad perspective informed by liberal education.
So it's really sort of a first cut at this idea of a pragmatic liberal education.
Absolutely. It is showing that liberal education can do work in the world. And I would not have written this book to defend an education system that just produces smart people who sit around together showing each other how smart they are. I wrote this book to defend a kind of education that I think has made this country so strong economically and culturally, because the education we have is producing work in the world. Mm-hmm.
Michael, we have about 5 minutes left. I want to get a sense from you as to what you see as the future of post-secondary education. You know, can these different paradigms coexist? You know, we have the liberal education model. There's a lot of talk now about building competency-based certification programs. You have residential, you have online. There are all these different approaches out there. Where do you see us heading from here?
I think it's a great time for American higher education because of the multiplicity of models that are out there. I think that the days are long gone when you can just insist on a conventional model of a 15-week semester and then go off and do what you will. I think the fact that we are trying new things because of technology, because of the marketplace, and because we have lots of faculty and administrators who are eager to innovate and to enhance student learning makes the American education system even stronger. We don't all have to imitate Ivy League schools, and they are sometimes more conservative than other institutions. We should, as educational institutions, be nimble, trying new things and breaking away from convention in order to enhance student learning. We shouldn't do it just to slot somebody into a job that's going to disappear in 5 years. We should do it so as to enhance student learning so that they can be productive members of the economy, but also responsible citizens and reflective individuals who can think about what they do and why it means something to them.
Yeah, I think, if I'm correct, that college-age students peaked just a few years ago, so there's a slightly increasingly smaller number of students in the applicant pool at a lot of places anyway. Do you think that the traditional notion of kind of a four-year liberal arts college that both you and I experienced, is that in danger, or do you think it'll continue on?
I think it should change, actually. There's no reason it should be 4 years other than the fact that it used to be 4 years. I did it in three at Wesleyan to save my parents money. We now at Wesleyan have a three-year program, as the students can save 20% off their total tuition if they go to school and do some summer work and some winter work. I think that more fluidity in colleges and universities, not everybody should be here for 4 years. Some people will be here for two. Some people will be here for six. I think that breaking the conventional mold will allow schools to innovate more broadly. I know at your university, the online work is really dramatic, and it gives students the ability to study a whole range of subjects at their own pace and when they want to. This is, I think, a great thing. And I do think, since I believe so strongly in lifelong learning, that having students who are not just between 18 and 22, but students who want to continue to learn at different parts in their lives, that also will have a strong impact, is already having a strong impact on colleges and universities. So the fact that we have 100 flowers blooming or 1,000 flowers blooming, I think, is not a danger for liberal education. I think it could actually be a great thing, as long as we don't use this diversity in order to dumb down the process and narrow our students' experience.
We actually just received an email under the wire from Jerry in Nashua, and we only have a couple minutes left, Michael, but real briefly, Jerry wants to get your opinion about, you know, with so much of a focus on courses that maximize prospects for employment, what about the women's studies, black studies, these sort of more specifically targeted program? How do they fit into the bigger picture?
Well, I think that the studies of identity and history are remain really important parts of an overall curriculum. Last year at Wesleyan, we had some very intense meeting with hundreds of students around African American studies. And at some point, we said, "Gosh, there are so few majors actually in this field." And so the students I was talking with were majoring in biology, and physics, and economics, and history. But they all were saying, "We need a strong African American studies program, for example, or a strong women's studies program. And I think it's because they see these fields of study complementing the STEM fields, complementing the other things on which they want to focus. We don't have to choose between narrow specialization and a broad education. We can have a broad education with people who learn real skills.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, we only have about a minute or so left. What's next for you? Obviously, you're kicking off the school year tomorrow, it sounds like.
We are.
But in terms of this larger debate about the future of liberal education, where do you see yourself heading with this?
Well, I'm just going to keep banging on the drum, Dean, to say, you know, that we don't have to narrow our education in order to make it powerful. In fact, the most powerful form of education today is a broad education that includes skill building. And I think that this has been a message that would have been resonated with Ben Franklin or W.E.B. Du Bois or Jane Addams. I mean, I think it's a good old American message. I'm going to keep bringing it to people, and I hope we'll find allies who want to develop curricula around the country that will enhance student learning and enhance their ability to do work beyond the university.
You got another book in the works?
Well, I've been thinking about a book around the problems of distraction and absorption that I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about, and there's a little piece in the book about the limits of critical thinking. So I'm thinking about a book that would look at how in an education model you can both have critical thinking but also the capacity to give yourself completely to a field of study or to a work of art.
Well, sounds like you got a full plate as we prepare to kick off another school year. I'm sure we're going to continue this very important conversation in the future. We are out of time, though, so I'd like to thank my guest, Michael Roth, for joining us this morning. President Roth, thanks so much for being with us.
Dean, thanks for the great questions. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure as well. That's Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. He joined us by phone from Middletown, Connecticut. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Puglia. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange on NHPR. Every day, you turn to The Exchange for thoughtful, timely, and in-depth discussions of the issues that matter to you. And every day, we turn to you for your thoughts, opinions, and personal stories. It's the healthy exchange of ideas that makes for great conversation and debate. Join me for New Hampshire's only statewide call-in program and become part of The Exchange, weekdays at 9 on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather, sunny and hot today with high temperatures mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Mostly clear tonight, some clouds moving in after midnight in the North Country. Tonight's lows mid-50s north, ranging mid-60s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Southern New Hampshire University's graduate program in community mental health and counseling in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. snhu.edu/pcmh.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday in St. Louis, thousands of people gathered for the funeral of Michael Brown. He was fatally shot by a police officer earlier this month. His death is being investigated by a grand jury and also by the Department of Justice. Police use of deadly force is unfortunately not uncommon. But some say the killing of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, and police reaction to subsequent protests could lead to a broader examination of police policy, community relations, politics, and race. New questions following the death of Michael Brown after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Senior Hamas officials say an extended ceasefire agreement has been reached with Israel. An official announcement is expected from Cairo soon. It was a quiet night in Ferguson, Missouri, after yesterday's funeral for Michael Brown, the 18-year-old shot and killed by a police officer 2.5 weeks ago. NPR's Sam Sanders reports residents say it'll take some time before things return to normal.
At Ferguson's Corner Coffee House, I Love Ferguson yard signs and T-shirts have been selling out. Karen Merritt came for 2 signs.
I'm going to have it out there as soon as I get home.
Merritt says Ferguson will be dealing with issues of race and policing and inequality publicly for quite some time.
You know, we're not going to wake up in the morning and, you know, or next week or next month and it'd be fine. There's not just one question, and there's definitely not just one answer.
Ferguson's first city council meeting since Brown's death was set for Tuesday evening, but the event has been postponed until the city can find a space big enough for the massive crowd it's expecting. Sam Sanders, NPR News, St. Louis.
The presidents of Russia and Ukraine are meeting today in Belarus, and there's optimism that the talks in Minsk might lead to a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. But NPR's Saraya Sahardi-Nelson reports that Moscow is downplaying expectations.
In Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said not to expect too much from the talks. He says Vladimir Putin